she could relieve at no cost to herself or him. Once, in despair, he'd let her. I remember looking down at her, at her head with that great sweep of wonderful hair lying across my legs, covering me, sort of rippling as she moved, and thinking, how can she be doing this and not loving me? I blushed in embarrassment at this. I could see it so clearly. I just didn't know what to do with my feelings. That was the problem. I was such a kid. I wanted to marry her. I was so in love. Anyway, finally, I got her to agree that we talk about it again in a year. She said to me, a year, you'll see. By the time a year is up, you'll have some wonderful new woman. And after that, she was always bringing people over to meet me. And of course, when you moved in, she wanted me to fall in love with you. I think that's part of why she wanted you in the house, actually. I remember her coming to my room, oh, several times, talking about you. I pretended to listen. I pretended to take her seriously. He looked at me intently. God, how I wish I had. I could feel myself blushing again. Do you? Of course. His hands moved forward on the table, as if to touch me, and then stopped. He looked away, took a breath. This is all so hard to talk about. Oh, I know. I think the only person I've ever discussed it with was Daniel. It's so impossible to explain her, for one thing, how powerful her lovingness was. Like some kind of blessing, like a heat or a light you could feel. He looked intently at me.
Yes,
he said. It must have been. I can imagine how hard it was to feel it go away.
To me, it was like dying, he said.
I reached over quickly and touched his hand. He was watching me. His eyes tightened thoughtfully.
It seems, doesn't it, that you and I were somehow meant to meet each other again?
I laughed. I was delighted, nervous. Careful, I said gaily. You're beginning to sound like a religious person.
God forbid, he smiled. Some entity or other forbid, please.
And now he pointed at my empty glass.
Will you?
He left the question dangling, as if he were asking about much more. Yes, I said, I would. He raised his hand for the waiter, signaled for two more drinks. Then he leaned back and looked at me once more, hard.
I felt then, and I feel now too, that if I hadn't been so overwhelmed by my feelings about Dana, I would have fallen in love with you. I remember wishing I could. I admired your generosity so much, your sense of morality. I thought of you as an adult. I was so rigid, so inflexible in my own judgment, so juvenile. And you seemed compassionate and grown up.
I made a soft noise of protest.
No, I mean it, Joe. Then and now, people don't change that much, you know. Or they change, but some central core remains there. I felt it. I felt familiar with it. With you. When you put Arthur away.
Euthanized him.
Yes, euthanized him. I think I said to you what a strange bond I feel it is.
The waiter came over with the drinks and a little dish of nuts. We waited while he picked up our empty glasses. He saw the drawing Eli had made on his napkin and paused.
Do you want this? He asked.
Eli shook his head, and the waiter crumpled the napkin and put it on his tray. When he left, Eli leaned forward again.
That's part of why I was so glad when you called, he said. I was worried you wouldn't, but I decided to be fatalistic. I wasn't going to call you if you didn't call me. And then this might not have happened.
His big hand opened in the air between us. All this. But I did, I said.
You did.
He smiled the warm smile that made his eyes all but disappear.
"Shall we talk about that night?" he asked.
I wasn't sure, really, what he meant. But because I meant yes, yes to everything, I said it, yes.
"That was the night. The year-end night."
"What year-end night?"
"That was the end of my waiting period."
"Oh, with Dana."
"Yes, exactly."
I reminded her of it a week earlier. He sat back and looked out the window, quickly, at a pedestrian walking by close to the glass. Then at me again.
"I suppose I should have foreseen what would happen when she came up blank. No memory of it whatsoever. And then, when she did remember, she was dismissive. Yes, fine, we talk, whatever."
His voice had hardened. What he was speaking of was only slowly dawning on me.
So, this was that night.
You saw her that night, the night she died?
Yes, I'm getting to that.
Why hadn't this come out before? I was wondering thickly, why hadn't he said this at the time to one of us, or told the police?
I came back to the house at the time I'd mentioned to her, the time I thought we'd agreed on, and there was no one there. I guess, well, you were at work, weren't you? I nodded. And Duncan, too, I suppose, and John had moved out by then.
And Larry and Sarah had gone to a movie together, I volunteered, impatient now.
Right, he said. Anyway, I sat there in the kitchen for half an hour or so. That's what we agreed on. Meet you in the kitchen at 9 o'clock. Actually, I went to the foot of the stairs, too, and called up a couple of times. I was getting really upset. Upset with Dana, upset with myself for being such a loser. I didn't know what to do. I felt so powerless, so forgotten.
I'd put my coat back on by now, my gloves. I was actually at the back door, in one of those frenzies of indecision, you know what I mean, not knowing whether to stay or go, and so frustrated I wanted to do something. Throw things around, break stuff. Anyway, suddenly, I don't know why, I had the notion she was upstairs in her room ignoring me. So I charged up there and banged on her door, and she was. Not ignoring me so much, but actually asleep, with the radio on. That's how unimportant it all was to her.
His voice was forlorn and bitter at the same time. And I remember that young Eli, and what I'd mistakenly thought was his devotion to all of us, to the house itself, the feel and spirit of the place.
Dana told him to go downstairs. She'd be there in a minute, and he went back down into the kitchen to wait. He was, he said, beside himself by now, pacing back and forth.
That's what I felt, actually, that I'd somehow taken leave of myself, you know what I mean?
I nodded, though I wasn't sure I did. Dana took her time, he said. She used the bathroom, he heard the toilet flush, and finally appeared, sleepy-looking and barefoot, in the kitchen doorway. He turned on her the moment she came in. Very controlled, he said, but very angry. Determined she should hear him out, should understand the wrong she'd done him. She was smiling, trying to pacify him, cajole him. He thought her tone was condescending. He thought she wasn't taking him seriously. She came over to him, patted his cheek. He pushed her away, went on talking. He wasn't even sure anymore, he said, what he was saying. Some combination of accusation and rage and profession of love and proposal of marriage. And through it all, Dana stayed serene, dreamy, as though he were a little boy, as though she could manipulate him. He'd remembered the blowjob then. He said that sense of feeling managed by her. He realized that she was just trying to quiet him now, too. She touched him again, smiling.
Smiling, he said, when I was in agony.
He hit her in the face. He didn't even truly realize he'd picked up the knife.
It was just to get her to stop smiling, to stop saying, "Sweetie, honey," to stop coming at him with her hands, her mouth, her body, to stop her. He didn't know what he'd done until blood leapt to the place where he'd struck her, leapt and flowed all at once. When he stopped talking for a moment, I was aware of my breathing. He spoke slowly now. He said she frowned and looked suddenly perplexed.
It was as if she didn't realize it either, what had happened. She touched herself.
His hand imitated her gesture, his large hand brushing his cheek with Dana's hesitant delicacy. She looked at her hand, her bloody hand, he said, and then back at him. And she said,
"Oh, Eli,"
in this terribly, terribly sad and disappointed way. Then she'd stepped toward him again, and he hit her. That's what he said. He hit her again and again, in the breast, the chest, the side, just trying to stop her. I can't say what I was feeling beyond horror at this point, but Eli must have read some sympathy in my face, and thinking it was for himself instead of for Dana's beautiful, pierced body and face, he leaned forward toward me, and he shook his head.
"I was just so desperate, so wounded."
And suddenly, shrilly, inadvertently, I laughed. At what? Clearly, at the use of the word "wounded" to apply to himself, but at everything else, too, I think, at my own misunderstanding of what I was doing here, at my stupidity, and at the horror, the way a child laughs, I suppose, when he sees a grown-up in pain, the laugh that expresses the wish that everything that's so terrifying could be made funny, that everything frightening really were a joke. Eli looked startled, offended even. And I apologized. "Sorry," I said. "I'm sorry. A kind of hysteria, I suppose." He nodded then and shook his head. Sudden fatigue, like the radical pull of some emotional gravity, weighted his face. We sat for a long moment. I felt frozen. I could hardly bear to look at him.
"So, you left her?"
My voice cracked as I asked it. I hadn't realized how dry my throat was. Terror had parched it.
"I know it seems like it, yes, but what happened was she left. She had this sort of stunned look on her face, and she walked out of the room, she just walked out like that."
His hand swept her away. He seemed actually puzzled momentarily.
"And then I left, too. It was like we'd had this terrible fight and we both just walked out on something."
"But you knew you'd stabbed her." He stared at me as though surprised by my failure to grasp something important.
"I did. Of course I knew it. But you have to understand what happens to people in these circumstances. In effect, I was in shock. There was that part of me that saw that she was hurt, yes. And there was a part that didn't, that denied it, that," his hand circled, "chose to disbelieve. That said, over and over, she walked out. It's a classic stress response, actually. So, on the one hand, I did these self-protective things. I went back to the lab. I washed up. I disposed of the gloves and coat. I started to work again. And on the other hand, when the police came and told me, I was genuinely grief-stricken." He shook his head. "I was appalled. It was as though I understood it, or felt it for the first time, really. Dana. Dana was dead." His face had twisted. I felt my throat clog as though I were hearing it now, too, for the first time. After a long silence, I found my voice. "But you disposed of the coat?" I said.
He looked startled just for a moment.
Yes, yes, that was easy enough to do in a chemistry building.
He cleared his throat.
All kinds of bad wastes, toxic, radioactive, are disposed of routinely, unquestioningly, by the janitorial staff daily.
He was explaining, teaching me something again, and he seemed almost relieved.
There was some tension about whether it would be gone in time if the police began to suspect me, if they searched the building, for instance, but that seemed unlikely. And then they focused their attention on Duncan for a while anyway.
We sat silent, our drinks in front of us. How fortunate for you, I said at last. Eli's face changed quickly. He sat up straighter.
You seem to think I took this lightly. Maybe you haven't understood me. This event shaped my life. I loved Dana. I mourned her for years, and I worked the rest of my life to assure that who I am has some meaning, some value beyond this part of my past. Look.
He hunched forward onto the table.
Remember once, back then, when you and I talked about accepting what's happened in the past? About the need to define oneself by what one gets up and does every day?
I saw this suddenly, this discussion in the kitchen, the young Eli and me, sweet, stupid children, chopping onions and peppers and arguing with tears streaming down our cheeks. But I remembered it differently. I remembered using these ideas to excuse myself for the pain I had caused the people I was closest to. He was still talking.
And I have lived my life that way, making sure every day,
he slapped the table twice lightly,
of its usefulness, of its meaning. I wrecked one life, yes, Dana's life. There's nothing I can do now to change that. But I'm giving now to thousands, to hundreds of thousands of other lives.
I had been made stupid by Eli's confession, unable, really, to focus on any one idea, any one thing he was telling me. But now, oddly, a thought came clear. "Does Jean know about this?" I asked abruptly. "About Dana?" He shook his head.
"No. I saw no need to tell her. It has absolutely nothing to do with who I am now, with the person she married."
I was relieved somehow, and then more confused.
"But so why did you tell me?" "You don't understand?"
"No, no, I don't at all."
"Because you know me, Joe. Because by now you know me again for who I've become. And you knew me then. Because you knew Dana. Because you saw how agonized I was by her death. Because it is an opportunity for me to talk about this with someone I have found wise and sympathetic. Completely balanced, actually, in the past. Because, well, as I said..."
He dropped his head and smiled almost shyly.
"It seemed nearly fated that you should arrive in my life at this point. Perhaps the one person, finally, to whom I could tell the whole story and put it behind me once and for all, because of what I've done with my life, what I've made of it after that episode."
Suddenly, I was struck, irrelevantly, with the oddity of the phrase, "put it behind me." I was remembering Eli on the front porch the day the taxi took me away, the yawning doorway behind him, the cheese who stood alone. "And what is it you expect me to do with this?" I asked after a moment.
"Do?"
"Yes." I was angry suddenly, at last.
"How shall I live with it?"
"Well, I don't expect you to turn me over to the police." So help me, I almost smiled back at him. Instead, I asked, "Why not?" He laughed as though I were joking and ignored the question.
"I suppose it could be said that I need a kind of forgiveness from you."
His face shifted.
"But I'm not sure even that's right. I've forgiven myself, after all, and as you once said, that seems the more important step. No, I think I've just felt a sense of our connection, our connectedness to get new agey about it.
I see. He was looking at me now. Perhaps it was occurring to him for the first time that he might have made a mistake. But he must have imagined alternative responses from me when he thought about this encounter. He must have given me options in his mind, mustn't he? Other than the one he was wishing for. I think perhaps he hadn't. At any rate, when he began again, his demeanor shifted. He leaned forward over the table. His hands came over into what might have been designated as my territory. Someone watching us from across the room would have thought the moment had finally arrived for him to start to make love to me.
"Do you remember saying to me once that you made an unforgivable mess of your life?"
His voice was ragged with intimacy, sweet reason. I didn't answer right away, though I did remember. But I saw where he was going, the parallel between our lives, and I didn't want to consent to it. He waited, watching me. Finally, I said, "Yes, I think so. I know I had felt I had once. Yes."
"And that's the point, isn't it?"
He smiled sadly.
"The unforgivable things we've done. We've all done, I suspect. Like Daniel's notion of original sin, we're all tainted. And the only way we can forgive ourselves is by redefining our lives. That's what I've tried to do, Joe. That's what I've done. I can honestly balance what I've accomplished against the harm I've done and say the one far outweighs the other. I grant there may be others who've done less harm, but nowhere near the good. Nowhere near."
After a pause, I said, "But it wasn't exactly penance, was it? I mean, you loved the work." He shook his head.
"I don't see the relevance of that, honestly."
I wanted to leave. I was frightened of him, I realized. Not of his doing anything to me, I knew he wouldn't, but of his apparent need to persuade me of his point of view. It seemed he wouldn't let me go until he had. He was waiting, watching me. At last I said, "I don't think it suffices to forgive yourself." He lifted his hand.
"Who then? I can hardly get Dana to forgive me."
This, more than anything, this casual near joke of everything that had happened, everything he'd done, shocked me.
"I don't know," I said.
I slid sideways out of the booth. I kept my coat with me when I arrived, and now I was grateful for that. I picked it up.
"I don't know."
I walked quickly across the room. I turned at the doorway just as I reached it, and I saw he was standing now too, throwing bills down on the table. His eyes met mine, and I felt a reasonless panic. In the lobby, I started toward the glass doors, toward the doorman and the people moving under the warm lights of the marquee. But nearly simultaneously, I realized that this was a kind of trap. I'd be standing there waiting for the valet to bring my car, waiting for Eli. Instead, then, I moved into a group of people standing by the bank of elevators, and when one of the mirrored panel doors opened almost immediately, I hurtled forward ahead of the others. The elevator operator smiled warmly at us as we assumed our places and gave our floor numbers. Someone else said 4, so I did too. When he opened the doors and called the number, I stepped off with the pregnant mother and the little girl who belonged there. I took a few steps behind them down the hall. Then I stopped. They went on, but I turned and came back to the door I'd noticed opposite the elevators, the door marked stairs. The instant I opened it, the plush, murmurous world of the hotel's life fell away. The floor was painted concrete, the rails were iron pipe. A cold, fluorescent light fell evenly, harshly over everything. I stood next to the closed door, listening to the rise and fall of my breath, the blood thudding in my ears and my chest. I was alone. I stood there for a while, I'm not sure how long, and then I heard someone enter the stairwell high above me, the quick, gritty tap of shoes on stone as he,
She started down. I opened the door again to the carpeted hallway of the fourth floor, and slowly I walked around, pretending I had a purpose, a destination. I came to a seating area in the corridor and stood looking out the windows there at the massive trees in the public garden, the lights twinkling through them. I kept seeing Eli's face, hearing his pleading, reasoning voice. I kept pushing away the image of Dana, Dana as I remembered finding her. And now, this new version of her too, stepping forward to offer comfort and being struck over and over. I heard myself make a noise and sat down, quickly trying to gather myself. A couple came out of one of the rooms down the hall and walked past me to the elevators, talking in low voices. A few minutes later, I followed them. They'd already disappeared. I pushed the down button. There was a mirror on the wall behind me. I turned and looked at myself in it. I was haggard, white. I looked away. When the elevator doors opened, I stepped in. Getting the car from the valet brought me back sharply to myself, made me feel aware of my own stupidity, my cupidity, my vanity. For what had I said when I took the stub from him earlier? I'm not sure how long I'll be exactly. I may stay the night. It's possible that I'll be spending the night. It's possible that I'll start an affair tonight with Eli Mayhew. His cheerful innocence now was a rebuke to me.
Decided not to stay, huh?
No, I said, and I stepped back into the glass vestibule to wait for the car. Every few moments glancing into the lobby, then out to the pavement, watching for Eli. It was such a relief to me. First to be closed in alone in the car, then to get onto Route 2 and be headed out of Boston, then to feel the silent dark of the countryside surround me, that I was well past Lincoln before I felt the weight of all that had happened. Somewhere after the sign to Walden Pond, I pulled off the highway onto a dark lane. I parked at its edge. As soon as I turned off the engine, I burst into ragged weeping. I don't know how long I sat there. I stopped crying several times and then started again. I thought of Dana, of the noise of my breath leaking wetly from her cheek where Eli had sliced her open. I thought of my blindness, the shameful vanity that had brought me to Boston today, that had tricked me, exposed me. I thought of how Eli had counted on me, of how he had been so sure I would forgive him. My mouth tasted bitter and tired. I blew my nose over and over. I darkened tissue after tissue with my eye makeup. I thought of Eli's false words. "He hit her," he had said. "Liar. Fucking liar." I thought of Dana as I'd found her, of the bloody flaps of fabric and skin at the torn edges of each wound, of the drying blood on the dirty soles of her bare white feet. I thought of the weight of her body when I tried to carry her with me. A car turned off the road and drove slowly toward me. Instead of passing by, though, it pulled up behind me, its beams lighting the inside of my car, showing me my frightened eyes in the rearview mirror. "Eli," I thought, and panicked. I heard his car door slam, the slow, heavy footsteps on gravel. I was fumbling for my keys, trying to start the car, to loosen the steering wheel lock when he tapped on my window. The engine caught with a sharp whine of protest, and I was starting to shift when he bent down. It wasn't Eli. It was a policeman. Young, hatted, his white face just inches from me. He frowned at me through the dirty glass. Daniel must have heard the car crunching on the frozen ruts of the driveway, or seen the lights skittering over the bare trees in the barn, for he came to the kitchen door to greet me, his glasses in one hand. His face lifted in surprise and pleasure as he stepped back to let me in.
"Hey, I didn't expect to see you for hours, if at all, tonight. What happened?"
and then he noticed I'd been crying and moved toward me.
"What's wrong?"
I stood utterly still for a moment. I was so glad to be here, home, but so ashamed, so conscious that what came next would change everything. Then I said,
"Well, see, Daniel, the thing is, I went to Boston."
I took a breath. "The real reason I went to Boston was to meet Eli Mayhew and watched as his eager, loving expression was utterly transformed.
Chapter 12. I said earlier that running away from my first marriage was unique in my life, that it was hard for me to recognize or remember myself as I was then, because the behavior was so foreign to me. But that was not strictly true. I ran away once as a girl, too, at perhaps 8 or 9. I didn't get far, but if intentions had been wings, I would have landed in Florida, in Brigadoon, in Never Never Land. As it was, I made several mistakes and was easily retrieved. The primary one was stealing my brother Fred's cowboy boots. I'd long coveted them. They were red, with white appliques stitched on them, crescent moons and stars. From the moment he'd unwrapped them the Christmas before, I felt that if there were any justice, any fairness in the world, I would have known about the existence of these boots. I would have asked for them for myself. They would be mine, not his. Now, on this dusty summer afternoon, I sneaked into Fred's room and found them in his closet. I carried them to the front porch. I pulled them on and set out on my journey. Down to the corner and left onto the street that became the road that led out of town, the place where all the journeys I'd ever known began. The boots swam freely around my feet as I walked. It was a hot day. My feet were damp with sweat. Within the equivalent of a few city blocks, I had blisters on both heels. At a point shortly after that, I took the boots off and left them in the tall grass that grew by the road. I went on barefoot, slowed by pebbles and glass. I was hobbling and miserable when a neighbor saw me from her car and stopped.
"Dearie," she called, "you're headed the wrong way."
I let her talk me into the car. I consented to let her drive me home. But nearly as soon as we started back, I burst into tears at the thought of my failure, at my barefoot shame, at the enormity of my sin in stealing my brother's boots, at the fear of being punished. By the time we got home, I was inconsolable, so inconsolable that there was only sympathy for my bleeding bare feet, for my hysteria, for my having been, as they understood it, lost. And what triggered that flight? What was the itch that time? This. My older brother had told me, it seems to me only a few days before, but it might have been weeks or even months, about my father's previous life, his first marriage. I don't know why he chose the moment. Some smugness on my part he wanted to pierce, some casual remark that seemed to claim ownership of our parents' history, some minor offense to him. At any rate, he told. Cruelly, harshly, the correction being to my stupidity for not having known earlier. Though, how could I? No one had even hinted at it, that our father had had another wife, another whole existence before he met our mother, before we were born, that if things had been as he first planned them, we never would have been born. There would have been other children living in our house, with another mother, with different rules, different notions of what was important in life. This shattered my understanding of the universe, the feeling I'd had.
I think every child has it until some point in life, that my life was somehow sacred and foreordained, the one absolutely necessary life I had to live.
Apparently not.
Apparently, I might never have been. Or I might have been other than what I was. And it occurred to me then, mightn't I yet be? It seemed suddenly that what had become the cornerstone of my existence was shifting sand, that what had been a given was merely a whim. It seemed possible that there was another life waiting somewhere out there for me. This was not exactly how I thought it out, of course. Mostly, I felt it, a yearning suddenly justified for something other for myself, better, more real somehow, more like the lives I read about in my books. Later, the boots turned up missing, causing my mother to ponder retroactively the mystery of blistered heels on a barefoot girl. A new interpretation was arrived at, and I was walked down the road, made to find the boots, rain-soaked and stiffened, curled, ruined, and punished. I don't mean to trivialize my feelings on coming home to Daniel by comparing them to that other homecoming. On the contrary, for that early shame felt deep and permanent, a stain I would wear forever, an agony I was condemned to wake to over and over, a final isolation I'd brought on myself by turning in the wrong direction, heading the wrong way, when I was confused and wounded. Each day now, too, I woke and felt something very like that agonized wrench of childhood. Sometimes, Daniel was not in bed with me. He'd gotten up, sleepless, and gone to one of the girls' rooms, or out to his study. Then, the disorientation, the pain, lay in his absence, in my aloneness in the bed. Sometimes I was the one who'd moved in the night. I'd wake with the light falling from the wrong direction, the bed turned dizzyingly the wrong way. And in the seconds it took to orient myself physically, I would be returning too, with a sinking weight in what felt like my heart to what I'd done. To all it seemed I'd destroyed. It was like waking over and over to an illness, a long fever I could not recover from. My brother had said to me then, "I'll never speak to you again." Of course, I believed him, and what's more, I believed I deserved it. Daniel might as well have said it. Though we spoke daily, we exchanged information about where we were going, about what time we'd be back, and occasionally more. Tonelessly, he'd sometimes tell me he'd run into someone I knew, or report on something he'd seen, something that had happened to him, the kind of thing that would once have been the beginning of a long, meandering conversation. But these were offered so listlessly now that I understood them to be mere formalities. Just as Daniel would not stop saying good morning to me, or how was your day? Just as he would make himself be civil to me in those ways, so he would politely, dutifully offer me nuggets that neither of us had the energy to turn into conversation. Though, at odd moments, the silence between us would be broken by the quickest, the most radical of exchanges about what was truly important to us. One of us would blurt out just a sentence or two, as though we couldn't bear to keep at it any longer than that, as though one idea at a time was all either of us could express or take in. These were sometimes preceded, these cries from the heart, by an oddly formal introduction. "Allow me, Daniel, just to say, I never meant for it to go as far as it did." And the quick answer, "I'm sure that's true." "I would ask that you never see him again."
"Of course not."
Once in bed, long after I would have assumed he'd fallen asleep, just before he got up and went to sleep elsewhere, he suddenly said in a rough, low-pitched voice.
I don't know how to stop thinking about it.
For once, my work was no consolation. The world did not fall away when I moved among the animals. As I touched them, as I manipulated them, as I treated them and thought about them, I was still too much myself, too much the Joe who'd wrecked everything. I didn't know anymore what it felt like to take satisfaction in anything. I couldn't remember when I had liked myself or anything about my life. My very voice made me sick. Its dryness, the way it cracked on certain words. I hated my need to smile at clients. I hated the sight of my ugly shoes emerging from underneath my scrub pants, the way my hands looked arranging things on my table, the way my body felt as I moved around the clinic in it. Though when Mary Ellen spoke to me quickly, privately, in the hall one day, offering to pick up the slack for a week or two if I wanted some time off, I understood, by the panicked rapidity of my refusal, how much worse things would be if I couldn't come in every day. A week passed since I met Eli, then 10 days. The world froze and we froze in it. The bird feeder hung empty. We opened the door and let the dogs run at night instead of walking them. Neither of us had the energy to make our bed, or any of the beds we variously slept in, or to pick up, to build a fire, to throw away rotting fruit or dried out flowers, or the old takeout containers that accumulated in the refrigerator. I felt I was living on pure will. Every act was a deliberate one, costly and difficult. I've said that once I felt held in my life. Now I was holding on to what was left of it for dear life. Dear life. While below our tepid, empty exchanges, the deep moat of silence widened between us. Of course, we had talked the night I came back, but even then, I knew how it was going to be. I could feel the coming silence and the long, poisonous pauses that expanded as the night progressed. I suppose in some way I knew how it would be even as I was blurting out my confession. But I couldn't have, I think I couldn't have stopped myself anyhow. Why? Why couldn't I have kept quiet? I asked myself that often in the days that followed. Why hadn't I spared him my painful, ugly little secret and kept things the same between us? I suppose the answer in part is that the weight of what I'd learned and the power of the emotional state I was in were so heavy and deep, it felt they had become me. I felt I had no choice. I didn't, in fact, think about an alternative. I suppose it was in part because I needed Daniel so much right then that my need made me stupid. I suppose I was so caught up with what Eli had said and the way it altered my own history that I wasn't thinking about how my confession would alter ours. But even as I spoke, had to speak, I was thinking, this is what you've done. Oh, God, Daniel, I'd said when I saw his face change, saw it go white. Let's sit down, let's get a drink or something, and then I'll tell you the whole story. I think at first I felt that if he heard all of it, if I explained it in exactly the right way, he would see how it had been, how I had been in it. He would be, as he always was, so with me, that he could feel it as I had felt it. He could help me now with my terror, my horror. And I think, I hope too, that there would be a way made available for my words not to mean what they had seemed to mean. He was still concerned, if not quite loving, when we sat down together in the living room, when I tried to start and burst into tears again. When I began my tale with Eli and Dana and their long-ago love affair. But after I'd finished that part of it, and his face had sagged in sympathy and horror, after he'd agreed with me that yes, this was a murder, no matter how it was explained, no matter what Eli had made of himself later, after all that agreeing and sympathizing were over, he'd stood and put another log on the fire, and from that distance he turned and asked me,
"So, what does all this have to do with your going to Boston secretly to meet him?"
And I understood that where the story for me was somehow all of a piece, for him, it was two quite separate narratives, with two separate meanings. Now I fumbled again to tell it, trying in a different way to call up the magic of my own past as my seducer, to explain the pastness in my attraction, to explain Eli as my betrayer, and to connect all of this to my horror at how it had turned out. I knew that this version wasn't strictly true. Part of me knew it wasn't true. But I was also desperate to have Daniel's sympathy, desperate for him not to feel what he was bound to feel, desperate to imagine I still had the power to make things right. While I spoke, he had come to sit at the other end of the couch. I watched his profile looking at the fire, watched it as his face pinched shut, his lips tightened in an embittered line. It seemed minutes after I'd shut up at last when he said,
"You will forgive me." Those were his words. "You will forgive me. If I can't really focus on Eli and Dana. I know that's part of your shock and pain, but..." He shook his head, and his nostrils flared slightly. "Fuck it. That's how I feel. Fuck that." We sat in silence for a long time then. I couldn't answer him. I sat thick-headed, staring into the fire. Daniel never used language like that with me, to me, and I felt the words like blows. Finally, he said without looking at me, "Be honest, Joe. Do me that courtesy. Be honest about why you went to meet him." It was as though I were in a nightmare in which the frightening thing was that I had no words. I opened my mouth, and no words would come out. At the same time, I couldn't believe that there wasn't going to be some way for me to make him understand me. At last, I started stupidly to go over it once again. I may even have been using the same phrases, since my brain would not work to find new ones. I know I started to weep again, too, but that felt suddenly like self-pity, and I tried to stop. Daniel was looking at me, as though he didn't know me. He stood up and crossed the room. He lifted the screen and set it in front of the fire, and then, with his back to me, he said, "You met him to screw him. You met him to fuck him. You met him to lie down with him and wreck our marriage."
When I didn't answer, he left the room. I heard him in our bedroom, moving around, and then he crossed the living room, holding some clothing and his glasses. Without saying another word to me, he went up the narrow stairs to the second floor. As we passed through the long days that followed, I sometimes envied Daniel what I thought of as the simplicity of his pain, his sorrow. He had been as good as betrayed. I had been ready to sleep with someone else. It was the most astonishing accident that I hadn't, though occasionally it seemed to me as I rewrote things mentally that of course I wouldn't actually have gone through with it. Of course I would have stopped. For me, the sorrow was laced with guilt. I was the betrayer, after all, and it was with a pained and startled self-recognition that I felt this as something familiar about myself. I had thought of it as new, as news, really. Something startling, something fresh I was learning about myself. It had even titillated me. I could be, I might be, a person who could betray someone. Now it came muddled with Dana's death, with that time in my life when I'd betrayed everything. My husband, my mother, my past. When I'd betrayed even Dana. I felt that way. I remembered that feeling by living when she died. It wasn't news then. Or was it old news, stale, sad news? And of course, pressing in on me every day, along with this sense of all I had ever done, now and in my earlier life, to hurt people who had only loved me, there was also the knowledge that I needed to decide what, if anything, I was going to do about Eli, about what he'd told me, about Dana's death. They pushed together, they merged in my mind, they became confused equivalents. Eli's killing Dana and my casual, sleazy destruction of all I would have called fine in my life. In this mood, it took a conscious effort for me to convince myself that what I had done was different in any degree from what Eli had done. The idea that I had any morally higher ground, that I should be Eli's accuser, seemed ludicrous. At other times, I actually thought that if I went to the police and accused Eli, there would be relief in it for both of us. It would be like accusing myself, too. I imagined that to put myself through such a thing, a confession, a full confession of how I had come to have this information, even as I was also making public the information, his confession to me, would be a necessary punishment for what I had done. What was it he had said? That we were all tainted. Yes, my heart said, yes, I am. And then I would swing into the mood opposite this. I would recollect my rage at Eli that evening. I would call up the image he had given me of his hitting at Dana over and over, the blood leaping to every wound. I would accuse him mentally of manipulating me, trying to trick me. There was no equivalence between us. Our betrayals, our sins, our taintedness were of an entirely different order, could not begin to be compared. Once, in this mood, I hit the examining table in my office so hard that Beatty came rushing down the hall thinking I'd fallen or dropped something. When I was feeling that way, what I thought was that I should report him so that he, the murderer, could be punished. But then I'd think about everything else he said. I'd wonder if it had been true. His sense that he'd lived his life redeeming himself by his work. And if it was true, was that enough? And was I in charge of seeing that he was punished, thereby ending the work, the good part of his life? Sometimes it would seem to me that what I needed to do was simply to forgive Eli in order to be forgiven myself. But, I tell myself, I didn't have that power, that right, to forgive or to be forgiven. It was, after all, Daniel whose forgiveness I needed. And Eli needed not mine, but Dana's, or her family's, or society's. And I could speak for none of them. The days dragged by. I would wake at night and move around the cold house, trying to imagine a solution. And I could not, because everything was so knitted together in my mind. There seemed nothing I could do, no action I could take, no remedy that didn't smack of self-interest or self-justification. And then even this fastidiousness, this self-examination would disgust me. It seemed like a further egocentrism, an intolerable dwelling with myself. Myself, whom I felt sometimes I could not bear. And with everything else, there was, of course, the shock, pure and horrible, of having to revisit Dana's death with this new understanding, this new way of envisaging it. Something I could not, of course, ask Daniel to help me with, though I wanted his help. I wanted him. As one does when threatened with loss, I fell in love with him again, with the tender note in his voice as he spoke in the morning to one of the dogs, with the white oval of his face turning up at me as though I might be someone else coming into the room, or another version of myself, with the mysterious private quality to his expression as he talked gently on the phone of someone else's sorrow, with his long, narrow feet, and the delicate tick in his toe bones when he descended the stairs from one of the girls' rooms in the morning. I thought of us silently together in the boat the day before it all began. I wanted him back. I wanted everything back. Once in the night, Daniel stumbled into the kitchen when I was there, and turning on the light, started at seeing me. There we stood, blinking at each other in the sudden harsh light. Each of us had raised a hand toward the other. I wanted, more than anything, to go to him, to touch him. I wanted his touch. When I thought of this moment later, I saw us as actors depicting yearning across a stage set, the black windows painted into the backdrop, the strewn table and angled chairs, the props, the main characters stage left and stage right, stopped in the act of moving toward each other. It seemed, for an instant, he might make some gesture to come toward me, or that gave me permission to go to him. It seemed so, but he didn't. His body slackened, his hand fell. He smiled, an ironic smile, a sad smile. "It's no fun at all, is it?" he said. During these weeks, we stayed away from each other when we could. For Daniel, this was easier. He could let his job expand to be as big as he needed it to be. Instead of being home for dinner before an evening meeting, he went to a restaurant with Morty, or the head of the committee on renovations, or the church musical director. He let the meetings themselves proliferate. I knew his strategy. He delegated nothing. He participated everywhere. And the church, the hydra-headed, many-mouthed, was all too eager to devour him. He was hardly ever at home. Since it seemed to me that I could speak to no one of what I'd done, of what I knew, of what I was so pressingly thinking about, I had fewer options. Daniel's absence unburdened me, of course. But when he was home, usually in his study, I almost always left. And even when he wasn't there, I sometimes went out, running from the emptiness of the house. I drove aimlessly down the country roads, through the dead and dying mill towns, the expensive, reconstructed communities. I parked across from working farms and watched the cows. I sat for hours next to unused fields, grown over with juniper and pines, filling in with thin maple saplings and chokeberries. I became an expert on where to find small coffee shops, the kind that featured square formica-top tables with plastic mustard and ketchup bottles placed on them like decorations. Or the locations of the ladies' rooms on my routes, in the basements of old town halls, around the back of wood-frame gas stations. I came home after work and drove out in the late afternoons, growing longer, twilight an event now. I returned after dark to the dark house. This was how it would feel, I thought, if Daniel died. I thought, he is dead to me. We are dead to each other. On a slow Saturday in early February, I left work early at Mary Ellen's suggestion. She'd stay, she said, her wide, flat face frowning in concern. I looked like I could use some time off. Daniel's car was in the driveway, though he wasn't in the house, probably in his study then, working on a sermon. I couldn't bear the empty silence. I decided I would walk down to the town library. The library was a strange octagonal brick structure, built in the late 19th century, one of only two brick buildings in town, the other being the post office. It had been endowed by the last of the Adamses, whose unfriendly portrait loomed behind the main desk as you entered the central hallway. I greeted the librarian, a starchy, skinny woman with dyed black hair, who'd been there as long as we'd lived in town, and went to the non-fiction shelves. I strolled aimlessly through them for a while, pulling out a book here and there, pretending to read. I actually got absorbed briefly by an account of the Ebola virus. When I'd put that away, it occurred to me I could use a computer to locate an article Mary Ellen had mentioned to me, an article in the Globe about the reasons for the increase in the numbers of women going into veterinary medicine. The computer room was in an alcove off the main reading room. There were six stations, all donated, hardware and elaborate software, by the same anonymous person who put the local elementary school online. I looked up my article and read it with mild interest. Then I wondered suddenly, how far back could I go? To exactly where I wanted to go, it turned out. It was a shock to see the photo of Dana, probably a high school graduation shot with her hair carefully flipped up, just so at the ends, her lipstick dark, her face childishly fat. The stories were as I'd recollected them, but there were more of them than I'd thought. It had loomed large, this murder, in a working-class neighborhood. It had scared people. What you could read under the surface as you went through the articles was that an attempt was being made to account for it, to be reassuring about it by offering details of the irregularity of the victim's life. It could not happen to you, the articles were saying, because you lock your doors at night, you sleep with just your husband, you live with just your family, you are responsibly employed. There was a photo of us, too, the house members, caught in someone's flash as we moved in a group together. Maybe leaving the police station? I couldn't tell. I had raised my hands slightly. They resembled two large mittens, and my face was partially obscured by my hair. Larry was next to me, looking thuggish and angry. Sarah peered directly at the camera, the light glinting in her glasses, her mouth slightly open, her face stupid. Eli and Duncan and John were just figures behind us, boys with that hair that was too long, too sloppy and too unkempt. I lifted my eyes then, looking away from this. And what I saw was Eli, the real, grown-up Eli, standing in the main reading room, seeming to survey it, really, with his air of ease and assurance. He wore a parka. His long, expensive scarf was looped around his neck. There was a shaft of sunlight between us, like a lens, an angled, particled brightness I had to look through. It created a strange sense of distance, of unreality. He was smiling at someone. Now he spoke, and Jean stepped into my line of vision and stood next to him. Together, they looked around the room with a civic, proprietary air, and then they turned as one, apparently to leave. As they turned, he saw me. She had already disappeared from the frame that the door had made for my view of them, but he stopped now, just inside it, at its edge. It seemed for a moment he might come over to me. He might have something to say. My legs stiffened almost involuntarily to rise. My chair slid back with a hard noise that made the other occupant of the computer room look over in irritation. And then he thought better of it. His hand lifted just a little in greeting, and he smiled at me. A sheepish smile, as though we shared a slightly embarrassing secret. And he was gone. Off, perhaps, to survey other properties in town that he, as a taxpayer, owned a share of. I sat there, tensed, shocked, and then, in a palpable wash of emotion, abruptly rageful. His very being, his health, his evident prosperity, his smile, his lifted hand, all of this was an offense to me. It seemed unbearable that he should exist in the same world I did, in a world where Dana was dead. It was all I could do to turn the machine off. My hands were trembling so. I slid my coat on and went outside. It was mild that day. The roads and parking lot were wet. The snow on the fields and lawns flattened and crusted on top with its own melting. There was the sound of dripping everywhere and the smell every now and then of pine or of earth. I walked slowly home, trying to calm myself. My coat flapped open in the gentle air. My boots struck the gravel road edge with a cheerful sibilance. A few cars passed me. The air they stirred pressed my coat to my side and lifted my hair slightly. In the house, I shed my coat. I went and sat down in the living room. It was silent, but for the steady whir of the humidifier, which, I noted now, was empty. I took the water chamber to the kitchen to fill it. Its opening felt vaguely slimy when I lifted the cap off, so I scoured it with soapy hot water before refilling it. When I'd replaced the chamber and turned the machine on again, I came back into the kitchen and looked around me. Everywhere, I saw the signs of our sorrow.